This week on Unglossy.
If you and I would fry something or sear something in a pan, I'm waiting for that. Otherwise, the pan is not right. You might have too much water in those greens, and then that becomes too high. When you fry something, it should be a little sizzle. If you don't need that sizzle, the oil is not hot enough. There's constant these movements of sound that, for me, indicate that this is what needs to happen.
From the top.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Frank.
I'm Mickey Fax.
And I'm Jeffrey Sledge.
Welcome to Unglossy, decoding brand and culture. I'm Tom Frank, partner and chief creative officer at Merit Creative. This is Mickey Fax, hip-hop artist and founder and CEO of Pendulum Inc. And that is Jeffrey Sledge, a seasoned music industry veteran who has worked with some of the biggest artists in the business. We're here to explore the moments of vulnerability, pivotal decisions, and creative sparks that fuel the relationship between brand and culture. Get ready for a thought-provoking journey into the heart and soul of branding, the unscripted, unfiltered, and truly unglossy truth. We had the great pleasure of being guests in an incredible restaurant in Atlanta in celebration of its first anniversary. The restaurant was Marcus Bar and Grill in Atlanta, and to talk about the experience and this guy's amazing story is today's guest, Chef Marcus Samuelson. Now, Jeffrey, yeah, this is your guy.
Yes, my guy. I'm sitting here thinking, and I really don't remember how we first met. I mean, we definitely met in Harlem. I don't remember the occasion, but we, you know, we met, we started talking, and then as you'll see when I say in the interview, Harlem is a neighborhood. It's not a borough, like a lot of people think it's a borough. Like, it was like Harlem, Brooklyn. There's no comparison. It's like, Brooklyn is a borough. It's like the second or third largest city in the state, Brooklyn. And Harlem is like a neighborhood. So I say that to say it's small. So you run into people, you know. And I was always out and about, you know, at a function, riding my bike or whatever. And Marcus and I were always bumping into each other. And we started to talk more and more. And he started telling me his life story. And he's a very inquisitive person as well. So he'd always ask me questions about Harlem, and he loves it. He's a music head, so we'd always talk music. And like he mentions in the interview as well, I was one of the first people he called when he was considering moving but putting a restaurant in Atlanta. So we just have a long-term relationship from being in Harlem and being, you know, music heads and just being around each other all the time. I really, really like him a lot. He's to be this world, literally world famous person. He's like, it sounds cliche, but he really is one of the most down-to-earth people you'll ever meet.
So,
yeah, you know,
I got to ask him. So you were one of the famous people that he would bump into in Harlem?
Yeah. I'm pretty famous in Harlem, Tom.
I have no doubt.
There's people definitely more famous than me, but, you know, I'm all right. I'm around. People know me.
people know Jeff, man. People know Jeff. And, you know, for me, I think it was fascinating to really just get a deep dive into this guy's backstory, right? You know, born where he was born, his upbringing and how he was taught the culinary arts and how he was able to establish himself in America and just like make a big splash in the whole culinary art genre in the underground scene here in New York City, as well as in the global stratosphere on television, and being able to win awards for the many things he's done. Just this whole story that we're about to, you know, get into is very, very dope. So I hope people really enjoy this.
I'm blown away by this guy's resume of accomplishments, from the youngest person to ever receive a 3-star review from the New York Times, winning numerous competitive shows, including Top Chef Masters, Chopped All-Stars, to all of his incredible restaurants, including where we are at, Marcus Bar and Grill in Atlanta, Red Rooster in Harlem, Hav and Mar, to his most recent accomplishment, a 2023 Emmy Award.
Yeah, and he showed us. And he showed it to us.
And we got to see. I got to see an Emmy. I like that. I got to see an Emmy. All right, with that, let's dive right in. Enjoy our conversation with Marcus Samuelson. Hey, Hey, Marcus, how you doing?
How are you?
We are good, man. Hey, I want to say thank you again. We had the pleasure, all of us, of spending some time with you in Atlanta, the Marcus Bar and Grill. You celebrated your 1 year anniversary. That's a big deal. Like, tell us about the event.
Yeah, well, thank you, first of all, for having me. You know, ATL has been so good to us. You know, the fourth ward, you know, we're not in Buckhead. It's a place where we feel really proud to be part of. And when you start something in a different city, in a part of town that some people told us, you know, don't go there, don't do it. You're not going to be able to make it. So to be able to, a year later, be there, celebrate it, all the successes with the team, with the staff, it's absolutely amazing. And Jeff knows, you know, I called him even pre-COVID. Hey, we're thinking about ATL. And Jeff was one of the first phone calls about the city, not just about the location, but actually about the city.
Thank you for calling me. I really appreciate that. I'm, you know, of course, I'm glad it's going well. I've eaten there, I don't know how many times, several times. The food is crazy. The ambiance is crazy. Somebody told me, a friend of mine, and she said to her, it's kind of like Atlanta's version of what the Shark Bar was in New York. Where it's like, it's not old, but it's a little adult, you know? The food is crazy. Yep. Everybody's kind of mixing and mingling. There's music playing in the back. It's a real young urban professional vibe. It's just, the place is beautiful, man. I suggest highly for everybody to go there. And it's right around the corner from Martin Luther King's.
Well,
I was going to say, it's been a very interesting location. And I'm sure that's for a very good reason, too. Like, how did that happen?
We take a lot of pride in opening. I mean, think about restaurants, right? Our restaurant, particularly, you know, we employ a lot of people. At Red Rooster, we're around 200 people. In Red Rooster, Miami, we're about 150 and so on. So, first of all, taking pride on finding spaces in predominantly historical African American communities. So, Harlem, Newark, Overtown, Fourth Ward in Atlanta. So that fits for us. And then being part of changing foot traffic in a positive way into those urban communities, right? And that's all about, you know, we open restaurants that are sticky, that people come to, and all kinds of community. But then also creating jobs in that community and being of that community. It's a little bit of harder start. We start probably a year, 2 years before we open the restaurant. But when it works, it feels so much better.
Yeah, because the restaurants literally become part of the community. Like, they feel like feel like they've been there 100 years. Like, they feel like the mom and pop kind of energy that people have been. So I understand exactly what you're saying.
And I've had the chance to, you know, I'm fortunate to have done this a couple of times. You know, I remember in Newark, we're in Halsey Street, we're not off Broad Street in the back, you know, and the guy from Naughty by Nature came in. It's like, hey, we used to have a shop here, and other people, you know, the lady came in. It's like, started to cry. She's like, it's amazing. This is where most of the drug trafficking in Newark used to be at, and now this is a place where people's going to eat and celebrate and create jobs. And just when you get that, that's real, right? That's not for, it's not a poster, that's real. When that happens, when you're that moment, you know, 500-600 people come to those openings that are of that community. And you know, when that lady from church comes out and talks to you, you better listen and stand straight. You know, so I've had that same thing in Overtown in Miami. So those are real experiences that I'd never forget. And obviously, I learned all of this from Red Rooster Harlem. I did not know how to do it before Red Rooster, but those 5 years before we opened Red Rooster Harlem, that's really when I took my PhD on studying and learning and being humble in the community, and how can you build off that? You know?
Exactly.
So before we dive into all that, though, we got to rewind a little bit. I want to hear, I mean, I'm talking to you were born in Ethiopia, correct?
Yeah.
And if I listened to one of your interviews correctly, you grew up in one of three huts in a small village. Like, how does a kid from Ethiopia end up in Harlem opening up an amazing restaurant? Like, what's the path? What's the story there?
Well, first of all, there's no linear path, I can tell you that. And then I will throw in a couple of other things too. Goodness of others. if I would not have been blessed by meeting people along the way that would just do a solid for us just because of love of humanity, I wouldn't be here. And luck, pure luck. Like my mother, my sister and I, we had tuberculosis. She walked us, the strength of her, she walked two kids and herself into the city, find a hospital. She passed away, but me and my sister survived. And then it was the nurse at that hospital that just said, you know what? I'm not throwing these kids back out on the street. Where are they going? I was two and my sister was five. So she took us. And that's just two things, right? She's breaking the law and she just know as a human, these kids cannot be back on the street. She took us.
Wait, the nurse in the hospital?
Wow. Yep, just took us. Mm. And she held on to us. She loved on us. We stayed at her house for 3 months until she set us up to be adopted.
Wow.
Right?
Oh, wow.
Wow. And think about it, in that time and what it would mean today. Like, you know, people would call it kidnapping or whatever. But she's like, no, I can provide for a couple of months. And then I'm going to walk it through and make sure that they get adopted. So all of that happened. And, you know, I went from being Kasahunsi guy, which is my birth name, to Marcus Samson in an 8-hour flight. I went from the warmest country in the world to the coldest country in the world. But so I say that always because the worst thing that could happen to you is to, you know, you're losing your mother and having TB, but it also became the saving for me and my sister, right? So I've been very fortunate, both with how it happened, but also for the people that looked out for me beyond wow. my knowledge.
Do you still have connection with that woman, the nurse?
I did until she passed away a couple of years ago. I, you know, I went back to Ethiopia 20 years ago, found my birth father, met my 8 sisters wow. and brothers, and wow. it's the whole thing. But don't throw out luck and goodness of others. You need everyone here on this have had somebody just randomly mm-hmm. at some point. You've either helped somebody or been helped by somebody. And that maybe was a major change in that person's life.
Wow.
It was for me.
So let me ask a question. When is the amazing. Earliest that you developed, because obviously you weren't cooking at that point, but you kind of developed a palate where you were like, I can, and can you taste, almost like an ex-girlfriend of mine always asked me, like, how do you hear music? Like, how do you hear it? What are you hearing? And so, besides the fact, I know you're a music head as well. Like, when you tasting things, is your palate, like, a little different? Can you, like, from your, you're like, oh, this is a little too salty. I taste some thyme in this or whatever, you know? How was the earliest you could start discovering that?
Yeah. Well, that was a lot there, Jeff. So I love the fact that you always go back to your ex-girlfriend. that's great. That's awesome. No, it's all good. It's all good. But I do think you develop a sense of taste. And for me, it came from my grandmother. It came really from two sides. My grandmother, my uncles. My uncles, they were fishermen. So we ate fish. When you were up there, when school was out in June, I was straight up in the car 10 weeks with my uncles and aunts. And that was a fishing village. So you ate fish 6 days a week.
Wow.
But you also learned how to take care of the boat. They gave you knives early. You had to butcher. You know, 8-year-old with a knife. Sure, you're in a fishing village. Take care of it, right? They also gave you never had to ask for money because they gave you fish that we could sell to tourists, right? So you're 8 years old and you got coin. I never asked my parents for money. You know, so there's so much. They also gave you fish to give to the elders. So there's so many things that I learned from that island that was just pure about humanity and common sense and food. And how salty it was, the fish was, when you live in a village, everything tastes salt, right? Because it's just around it. But for my grandmother, it was pure love and just fundamentals. We don't buy any. If she didn't have to go to the store, she took pride in not going to the store, right? To the point where you're like, as a kid, you're like, yo, we can go and buy this. She's like, absolutely not. To the point of my Levi's jeans. I never had Levi's jeans. I had denim that looked like Levi's.
That she made?
Wow.
And she made. She wow. made everything. That's why she the only place that she couldn't follow was with sneakers. So she kind of just, she didn't like sneakers because she couldn't make that. She's like, some American stuff. Wow. You know, she didn't trust that. So, you know, as a kid, I took so much pride in my sneakers. But so foraging was not something that it was a necessity. You go out in the woods and this is what you look forward to. These are the mushrooms. So my palate came from nature. Mm. And again, Sweden is a fairly large country with a small population. So the woods and ocean and nature is everywhere. So it was a place where food and ocean and taking care of nature was big.
Wow.
So I know you said luck was involved, but and which is true, and somebody helping you. Like, what was that journey like from Ethiopia to, like, what was the first big break? Like, what was the first restaurant you worked in? Like, what was that experience?
I always say one of the biggest blessings is being Black and an immigrant, right? Because it forces you to be prepared and it simplifies things. So wherever I needed to go, it's like being an athlete. You knew you needed to be number one. Mm. If we were looking for a scholarship for me, I had to be better. Okay, I grew up in sports, so it's like there's no secret how to get better. You work harder.
Work hard and practice.
Yeah. Work hard and practice. And I did that in soccer, and I could do that in cooking too. And it, you know, I got the scholarship. I got a chance to go to Japan as a teenager. It's a Black teenager. You know, I could speak English at a very early age, but you're in Japan. No one speaks English. So it just like your social and emotional contact with people just goes up on a different level. And it's, I always said I wish every young teenager has opportunity to travel as far as away, wherever you're from, go the opposite.
No, as far away as humanly possible.
Humanly possible, where people have different culture and look different like you. Because quite quickly, if you're going to accomplish anything, it needs to be eye contact. It needs to be hand contact. And you need to collaborate. And that's what I learned.
So how old are you? You're a kid in Japan. You don't speak the language.
No.
Are you by yourself? Did somebody go with you?
No, I stayed with the family. I stayed with the family, which was great. So they were a responsible exchange program, and it was the best thing that could ever happen. Because you, when you live with a family, right, you do everything. You go to that temple. You do everything, and it was great. But coming back from that, I felt like I had one up on my competitors, like the kids that were really talented, because I'd seen something that they'd never seen. I had sushi, I had ramen noodles, I knew what umami was, which was this flavor combination that we now take for granted because everybody's had miso soup and sushi and so on. But back then, nobody had it. And from there, you know, I had a chance to go to Switzerland and France. And again, different languages, right? I grew up in Swedish and English, but in France, you have to speak French, and in Switzerland, German or French. So I had to teach myself those things. So I just felt like, this is the challenge. This is what the journey we're on, and you just gotta focus, you know, and the love for it. I enjoyed being in the kitchens, being able to hang, and you can. You're 18, 19. You're gonna have fun with other 18, 19 years. You know, regardless your differences, you're just gonna enjoy the journey because we are these weird kids that are like athletes, but we're in food. It's almost like you play violin or something different. But you can do it all over the world. So you're going to find other violin kids, right? You know?
Did you find having traveled and cooked at all these different places that ultimately you pulled a little something from every place when you go to different, as you start thinking about your menus and your individual restaurants? Yeah. Is it, because you really can't be defined necessarily by one type of cuisine, right? Because you've had that experience with so many different kinds.
I was always writing. And that was something that I started early. I was always writing food, just like a musician, just like you're a rapper. You write your lyrics. You're influenced by other, but you're writing your own. And that little logbook is, you know, take my wallet before you take that, right? That's like the last thing you're going to give up in a fight. You knew back then all cookbooks were French. Everything was French. But since that travel, I knew that there was other food out there in the world that tasted just as good or even better to me. So I think it helped being of color because then you don't have to buy that everything had to be French. Mm. I'm like, what about Africa? What about Asia? What about South America? My French young kid friends, colleagues, they didn't ask those questions because it was a period also where you didn't ask any questions. But even when we were cooking for each other, we were just kids, no teachers around, they still weren't curious about what's happening in these places. I'm like, that's crazy to me that you don't want to see the rest of the world, you know? And it's just, I think that's why, again, I think being Black and the blessing of being Black and an immigrant forced me to look into my identity, learn about myself, having those questions, and what else can you do, you know?
No, I wanted to ask you, man, like, I mean, I'm sure it's in other cultures too, but among, you know, Black culture, because of our history and everything, so much of our recipes are here with the elders. Oh. It's not written down. It's like, nah, you do this and,
yep.
You know, then the little girl or boy gets into the kitchen as a young and they say, nah, you put a little pinch of that.
Yeah.
You just like, what do you think about that process as opposed to having like the written down kind of hard, you know, cup of sugar, blah, blah, blah. You know, you got this a whole different cultural thing.
Well, it happens in music too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to have freestyle that just come, the griots back in West Africa, right? They were on the square, you know, speaking the truth from that community. And then you have the writers that officially wrote it down. So I think you need a little bit of both. You know, I went to those great places to learn structure, to learn where is the modern cooking coming from? What's the past, present, future? And then you need a little bit of that freestyle moment as well, particularly because we're not written into that culture history, right?
Exactly.
So I'm asking myself those questions deeper because of who I am, because of my background, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, wherever I went, I had music with me. You know, it started with Sony Walkman, right? And then you go into your CD thing, and then you eventually, and listening to Black music all over the world was always the two things I would look at was Jean-Michel Basquiat, if you could do it in art.
Mm. Yep.
And then, you know, following really Prince, really, truly, like understanding that he could do it at such a high level all over the world, and his band always kept changing, and the bands by themselves were incredible. Not
incredible.
Prince, just the band by himself were also bands. So I'm like, there are, and I, you know, following not just Prince, like looking at Michael's video, that was just perfection, or thinking about, you know, I was always impressed with Tribe Called Quest because they were closer to my age. And I was like, how can he do this? How can he draw from jazz? Like, I've never heard anything like that. And I was like, for me, Tip was one of like, it was just on a different level in terms of operating. Of course, you know, when I came to New York, it was during the Chronic and all of that stuff. So I'm like, oh, LA is doing this too now? What's going on? You know what I mean? So watching Black art at the highest level, because that's the only access I had being in Europe, inspired me to like, oh, if this can be documented, told, I think I can do it. You know what I mean?
It's interesting. It's really interesting.
Because those were also in moments you have to think about. All the rockers hated on rap back then, right?
What? They hated on it. So they
had to break all that down. And I'm like, that's the same thing with what I would think about. Well, I'm going to do a little bit of French basics, but still the food's going to be about this. So I knew there would be a lot of sort of pushback, but I'm like, yo, if these guys can do that and like being in their 20s, you know?
Yeah. And it's also interesting what you said, like, because it happens again with music. They're very parallel. Like, you know, when I worked at Jive, one of the lessons I always tell people is Jive was a New York-based company, but our music wasn't New York-based. We were all over.
Yeah.
So as an example, if you go to Oakland and you just play some Too Short, it kind of sounds better.
Yeah.
Because it's of that community. It's almost like, I understand this shit now because this is what he's talking about. Or if you go to Texas and you play UGK, it's like, I understand. So I'm assuming it might be on the same thing with food, where like if you're in Africa and you're making African dishes, it almost like tastes better.
Yeah, no,
because
terroir.
You're amongst the culture of it, you know?
Yeah, no, the terroir, you know, Oakland. You listen to Rafael Sadiq, you know he's from Oakland. You know, you can just
tell right away. Right away.
You know, and no, but whatever. I think the tarot, the place totally makes sense. But you know, you gotta have, I always say you gotta have humility on this shoulder and arrogance on this shoulder, because you gotta have the humility to do the work, right? And look past, present. And then you got to have the arrogance to screw all of that. I'm going to do my way.
Your own thing.
You got to do your own thing. Because for me, it's like the whole point of coming to the United States, the whole point of the existence of being here is that you do your own thing. Like, what's the point? Like, I mean, like, this is being in New York, grinding in New York, the whole point is to meeting creative people, getting questioned, getting a couple of FU in the subway, but taking that the right way. If you can't do that, don't be in New York. You know, it's testing you constantly.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean? It is.
And then
it
you get inspired and then you go, you know? It doesn't mean you have to stay in New York forever, but like you need that, okay, this is what this is. People truly don't give a shit. You really got to like go in and grind and find your own. Okay.
You got to go for it. Yeah.
And you took a leap of faith to get to New York, right? I mean, at lunch when we were talking, I was kind of amazed that you worked for a pretty big chef that was a big deal to work with.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a certain path that you were supposed to take that you just decided not to take.
He kind of gave me an ultimatum. You know, he was young, but he was in a leadership position. And he just said to me that was younger, right? I was 21, 22. And he was like, yo, you know, wasn't even looking up. He was like, hey, go back to your parents, come back in 2 months. I got a job for you. And I said, no, I can't take this. I think it's time. And I started to study. It's like, what? He started to look up. I said, no, I can't take it. It's like, you do know that there's a line out the door of kids who wants to work. I said, I know. I know how long I waited to get here, so I got it. I was like, I think I have to start. This is the day when I'm going to start working on my own restaurant. And he just looked up and said, well, let me simplify. It's very simple. It can't happen. No one's going to come and support a black-owned restaurant. Do you know anyone in France that is black and has a fancy restaurant that you want to create? I said, no. And do you know anyone in Europe? And I was like, no. I said, that's your proof. That's your proof of concept. You can't do it. You can get a job with me, but you can never own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a moment where everything gets questioned. All these 7 years of work that you went up to, it's like, what do you want to do? And I called my dad, and he just come home. Just come home. We'll figure it out. He didn't have it figured out at that moment, but he's like, we need to think collectively. And I jumped on the train, and 30 plus hours later, I was home. A lot of time to think. And he said, you know, do you know anyone in New York? I said, yeah, I do. It's actually a Swedish restaurant. He said, do you think you can get a job? I said, absolutely. At that point, my resume, my CV was tight. I knew I could get it done. He just said, reached out to them, because if you get into New York, you get a job in New York, eventually you can own your own restaurant, because they just voted for a black mayor. And any city that votes for a black mayor will support a black-owned restaurant. So you're going to New York. That's it. That's how I got to New York.
Wow. I know we spoke also, you talked about Jezebel's as being like the epicenter at that point of blackness, really.
Yeah.
It was everything. It was dance. It was art. It was fashion. It was talk a little bit about that experience as well.
I mean, our restaurants, the black restaurants in New York, they were there for decades, but they rarely showed up in traditional media. So it's like a lot of stuff in our culture, right? It's there on the underground. It's there for us. And then there's there for people of like white people or Asians or other people that are in the tribes and have friends in that community, right? So it's not like they're all black, but they're of black culture. And just like great R&B or great reggae or great ska, whatever we go to, right? And I lived across the street from Jezebel, so I saw that magic every night. I saw the black town cars pulling up. And think about Hell's Kitchen in the 90s. It was still in the middle of the last end of the crack epidemic.
Yeah, it was still grimy.
Yeah, it was still grimy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So people were walking crazy down the street. and then all of a sudden, like, you know, the Knicks showed up, and those 5 yards between the black car and walking in, anything could happen, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Alberta Wright, Miss Alberta Wright, she knew that, which happens to be the great actor Michael Wright's mother, Five Harvey, and, you know, incredible actor.
And Sugar Hill.
Sugar Hill, of course. So between the two of them, there was so much star pull there, right? Paletta Washington, Denzel's wife, that was a big part of Black Broadway, could play the piano in there, or Luther can be in there with his team, you know, but also bankers and, you know, a young Bevy could be in there, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Vibe was doing something. And I couldn't really afford to be in there, but she's like, sit in the bar, have a drink, don't talk to anyone. But she's like, Arthur's like letting you in, but don't embarrass me.
Yeah.
And I watched this. She had those swings, right?
I remember those swings.
Yes. And she, for me, spoke to this je ne sais quoi that Black excellence has. She's never gone to design school. She designed the restaurant. She's never gone to cooking school. She was the chef. She's never learned anything about wine. Her wine list was crazy. Mm. And so I was like, and at the same time, and when I was there, she was building Jezebel's in Paris, right?
Wow.
So ambition, like, incredible, you know, and it could be done. And I didn't know really what to do with that. I just seen it. Once you've seen something as a young person, you can't unsee it. Mm. Then, of course, Shark Bar was happening, right, which was fun. But I understood Shark Bar. It was a cool place. Food was so-so. Vibe was everything.
Vibe was everything.
Yeah. But Jezebel, they were operating at a high, high level. I was also inspired by B. Smith, you know, grace, elegant, beautiful, rest in peace. So I've seen something around the Black restaurants. So it was just like, how come no one is documenting this? But the joy that was inside those restaurants was better joy than what I had in my restaurants in Midtown, where bankers came in, they swiped their cards, and boom. Transactional dining, very important, but no one walked out high-fiving or hugging each other the way, you know, the aunties are hugging each other when they leave, coming from celebrating a graduation or whatever, reunion, whatever it is. And I'm like, how can I bring that? And I know those days in the 90s were the days for me when I was thinking about Red Rooster without even knowing it, right? So 10 years later, creating it.
Interesting.
So, you know, I want to step in because, you know, these guys, they hogging
up. Step in, bro.
There's a lot of synergy here between music and cooking, right? I'm not a chef. I'm not a world-class chef, but I like to cook pretty much every night. Mm-hmm. And there's a solace in cooking and having my headphones in while I'm listening to music. What, for you, Marcus, is the soundtrack or what has been some of, you know, if you can recall some great dishes that you may have created that had a soundtrack behind you that inspired you to create some of the dishes that you've done.
Wow. Well, first of all, there's a lot of musicians who are in food, whether professional or not, like, you know, Jerobi from Tribe, he left Tribe Called Quest in the height of Tribe to go to cook culinary school, right? Which is that he should definitely be your guest on the podcast.
Yeah, we get Jerobi on there. Absolutely.
His story is crazy. You know what I mean? Yeah. We love, shout out to Jerobi. I would go back to always thinking about crescendos and horns, thinking a lot about Earth, Wind, and Fire, for example. Like, da-da-da-da-da. Like, that's a, you know the sound, and that's how you can create a great dish. It's very... There are movements to it. There is a bridge. There is movement to a great dish, and you need contrast in that dish. We think about the food from salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami. We think about it structurally from aesthetic, texture, fragrance, and temperature. Those are the nine steps how we build. Just like you guys would write a song, lyrically, with your, it's 14 bars, or, you know, all of that stuff. But, you know, I think about, again, I go back to Prince, like there's so many songs where the mood, how he creates it, when he stops, or even something like James Brown that starts on the one, for example, it's different beats, it's just different way of introducing music or introducing food. And so I think about it a lot like that, like even Afrobeat, right? The way in general in Africa, we are in general, they're vegetarian cuisines that has some proteins. In the West, we start with the proteins that have some sides.
Right.
That's just a different way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, the way very often we eat with a spiritual compass, you know, Ramadan or Orthodox that are fasting 200 days of the year, that does not mean they don't eat well. They just eat differently. So when you break those fasts, you break it with food and music. And very often when you break a long fast, the music gets much more, what we would say, hysterical or spiritual, right? And so the celebration, because the celebration, you haven't eaten for a while, and then you get, you're going to introduce meat, it becomes a celebration. So it's you have to kind of first understand culture, other culture than your own, to really appreciate the why.
Right.
We're always so quick on just getting up. But the why someone get there is very, very different. And when you have great exchange, like Stevie have with Phil Akuti, you get great sound. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it happens in modern time too, right? Like, Burna Boy is we're collaborating with everybody. And that's on the famous side, right? But we all know that the most collaboration are not happening among the superstars. It's happening around people, just sharing, you know? So...
Yeah, I mean, I always, you know, liken that, because, you know, music and cooking or dining in general, they just kind of go hand in hand. You go to a 5-star restaurant and you hear ambient sounds of music, whether it's classical music in a 5-star restaurant, or if you go to Marcus Bar and Grill, you'll hear some, you know, hip hop, or you might hear some, you know, Afrobeat, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like there is a spiritual connection between, you know, dining with people and having, you know, soundscapes as a soundtrack to that particular, you know, meal that you're eating.
And also cooking itself has a sonically sound, right? Like for me, when if you and I would fry something or sear something in a pan, I'm waiting for that. Otherwise, the pan is not right.
Yeah,
you might have too much water in those greens, and then that becomes too high. When you fry something, and you should be a little sizzle. If you don't need that sizzle, the oil is not hot enough. There's constant these movements of sound that, for me, indicate that this is what needs to happen. Just same as when you guys build when you build a song, you know what's going to happen on that one. You know what's going to happen on the three. You know what I mean? So it's very similar, and. You know, it's also everything music happens in music. It's pulled from somewhere from the past. Everything you have in cooking is pulled from the past too. Right. And yet you're trying to create a unique dish or a unique sign or a unique bar, right?
Fire.
No, 100%. Okay. And to me, you've kind of tapped into something here. We're talking a lot about like culture, and like this show in itself is really about brand and culture and how – to really build a brand, you have to tap into that culture. How do you think about, I mean, you've developed a personal brand now. And I feel like maybe not at first, but at least now, every decision you make really comes down to continuing to build that brand, right? And building that brand through connecting it back to culture. Like, is that something you think about, or is that just something that has happened?
I think you said it really well. In the beginning, you can't do that, right? You got to go for it. But as you evolve, I think evolution and evolving is really, really key, and keeping curious, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking now, like, what is AI? How's AI going to impact the consumer side and how we as chefs cook? If I would say, oh, screw AI, that's stupid, that's not for me, I'm done. Because we know that the consumer side and the chef side is going to evolve in that.
Yeah.
So you have to always be curious about what's coming, and then... You know, for me, the decision I make is very much around my own community and saying, like, you know, it's important that young kids can think about them as world-class Black chefs. Why not? Of course.
Right.
I think a lot about the company taking it into design, because we've been designing spaces forever, environments always, you know, and sometimes you just got to go there, right? No one, you were on those sets, Jeff, at Mrs. Elliott's videos, right?
Mm-hmm.
You knew that 25 years later, they would be iconic and also inspire beauty in a completely different shape or form, right? So you guys just have to like figure out, you have this world-class, incredible talent. All right, let's go with it. This is how we're going to send her out to the world. Mm-hmm. If the world is ready or not, we don't care. This is what it is. And now, 15, 20 years later, the world has came around and said, oh, it's the most incredible thing in the world. But you guys just had to go with the, what it was. So we have to claim spaces and do stuff. No one's going to give us a green light and said, oh, you guys are there now. Welcome in. You guys have slammed that door.
Yeah, you got to run through the door. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you got to stick with it. Because like you said, more times than not, it doesn't happen right away.
No.
You just got to keep going. And the people will catch up to you.
Yep.
To what you're doing and trying to change and shift the culture a little bit, you know?
And that, again, I had the musicians to look at, right? Because it was visually there. And of course, through the music. And so I know, like, also being in Harlem, it's going to sound a little nostalgic, but, you know, I knew Maya Angelou. Do you know what I mean?
She lived on the block.
I know Dapper Dan. It's not, I'm not bragging.
You see him walk around all the time.
Now, to Jeff, it's like, of course you do, but like, I'm saying this for the listener.
Yeah.
So when you're around, you know, the Bevis, the Dap, the Thelma Golden, having coffee with them or seeing them on a regular, they're not good. They're amazing. Dap is amazing. He's not good. He's incredible. Better than you can even imagine what the clothing is. He sits me down and I'm like, yo, if I'm representing part of this neighborhood, I got to do it on that level. He sets you down. Here what it takes to play. If you're going to get me to, you know, check the box for you, this is where you need to play at. Do whatever you got to do, but I'm not coming through on this is checked. And he's not going to be rude to you. He's not going to say, no, you didn't match. You're just not going to come through and vouch. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
I do want to say that because you brought up a couple of times, like Harlem is such an inspiring place. Because first of all, people, you know, outside the New York area, sometimes get it confused. Harlem is a neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's not a borough. It's a neighborhood. It's only a
two-block.
It's a neighborhood. And then all this talent since the beginning has come from there. And it's just, I guess, it's 40, 50 blocks, you know, east to west and up and down. And such, it's like I said, we spend time in Harlem. It's such an inspiring. It's inspiring because you're bumping into people on the street, people you know, and people you might not have heard of. And later on, you'd be like, yo, that was the stories these people told me were incredible, man. So I definitely see how having the Rooster in Harlem, especially the location you're in, you know, which is prime time, inspires you to do so many things because it's epicenter. It really is the epicenter.
Yeah, and it's constantly stories that, you know, of course, we know about James Baldwin. We know about all of this incredibleness, talent that was in here. But think about modern time, right? Ted Riley grew up on the block, created the, you know, New Jack Swing, created songs for Michael and for so many more, right? You know, like, there are modern, you know, like, I think about not just through music, but through all of it. People are here, and there is something about the institutions being there too. Like Apollo is in the middle of the neighborhood, right? Schomburg is a couple of blocks away. So you're around greatness, and it shapes you. And the culture is so in your face. If I go to Rutgers and watch basketball, you know, think about the legends. Kobe played there. You know what I mean? Like, so everything has that weight on it. That makes it harder sometimes, but it's also like the why you're there is also incredible, you know?
So as you, like, so in Harlem, right, with Red Rooster, you're in that area. With the Marcus Bar and Grill in Atlanta, you're in that area. Mm-hmm. Like, as you start thinking about this from a real estate perspective, right?
I mean, yeah.
That is absolutely key. Like, how do you, like, when you go to your next place, how do you figure that out? Like, that is a very conscious decision to be in a very specific location in each of those cities.
Yeah.
How do you do that ultimately? I mean, that's tough, right? You can't just plop a restaurant where you propped Red Rooster unless it took years of timing and years of research to really develop that?
I think it's about thinking through your narrative and story, and can you do it? Do you really believe that you have something to say and you can do it just as good or better than what's there? If you don't think you can do it, you shouldn't do it, right? So when we came to about Red Rooster, I had tremendous amount of respect for my two neighbors, mm-hmm. Lennox Lounge, that's been there for 75 years, and Sylvia's, has been the icon at that point for 50 plus years. So if you're going to have something to say, you better say it, because otherwise they're going to figure out real quick, right? So for me, it was always about honoring and never even going in their lane between either one, but being inspired and honoring both, right? And we felt like we can do something different than them and actually become, now the block can become good, right? But it was never about doing, oh, Sylvia's there, therefore. No, you gotta hold your own. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so end of the day, it takes a lot of belief. Like, I believe we can do it, and this is a path and plan. And then there's also that humility. Like, we used to go, I'm not straight, like in the way I've processed something. 3 years before we opened Red Rooster, we used to go to a ton of Paul Mooney concerts at Lennox Lounge with some of my potential investors, because if you can't stand Paul, don't be part of this, because this is what it's going to be about, right? And he will yeah. set you out.
And Paul's another one yeah. you would just see walking up the street.
Walking up the street. So at Lennox Lounge, we're like, it might be 70 people in the audience, so it's intimate, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like doing that level of homework that is not just demo where's the best block. It has a lot to do with understanding the culture and respecting the culture. And, you know, when we opened Marcus Bar and Grill, I listened to a ton of podcasts about, you know, one of my favorites was with Dallas Austin, moved from Cincinnati to Atlanta. You know, he was doing records at 12, 13, 14 years old, already doing records. Like, what? Like, what? And then, like, his cousin was a DJ. Like, just thinking through those cultures and why Atlanta became that hub, speaking to Erica Reed, LA Reed's wife, understanding how the 90s in Atlanta was built, and then you get up to Jermaine and Usher and all of that. So for us, it's like, okay, that's a vibe that we can build a restaurant off. Why you see the roller skates really came from that Cascade that feels very ATL, right? They're not just up there because there's, you know, they're
cute. Because it looks cool, yeah. But it looks yeah. cool, but it
yeah, something. And it, yeah. sure, can be double win, but and then so it's really like, okay, if we're gonna be part of this, you know, same thing before we opened Red Rooster Miami, I was like, Uncle Luke has to come through. We can't open before. We gotta go and get him. So he came through, and he's like, you know, sure, it's cool, whatever. But we were so for me, it was like Miami growing up. You know, Two Live Crew, the whole thing. It's like you were like, you couldn't tell your parents about it. Like, it was the whole thing. But I'm like, we have no right to be in Miami without checking with the unk first. You know what I mean? So it's always about checking those boxes, you know?
So yeah. Beyond just opening up restaurants, you have books.
I got this.
Okay, you beat me to the punch.
You made me.
Now you stunting on us now. Now
no, because last time you asked.
We asked where the Emmy was. So you got to tell people. You won an Emmy in 2023. Yeah. I'm so excited that you have that right there. You got to tell us a little bit about this Emmy.
Yeah, you were excited. I was excited too, by the way. And it's funny how.
Sidebar, your fit was tight for the Emmy.
Yeah, it was tight.
I saw the pictures. It was tight.
But you know,
show love.
How it is, you know, it was. That piece we shot was done in one of the toughest times of my life. And it's funny how life can go that way, right? Because it was in the middle of the pandemic. And as you know, hospitality had pivoted to basically take up business.
Yeah.
And we had at that point closed Red Rooster, but what saved me was really getting up every morning, serving the community, putting my mask on, putting my gloves on, serving 100 people a day, 200 people a day, 400 people, up to 1,500 people a day, boom, for 6 months. And that work, you know, that rhythm and the dialogue we had back and forth with the customers, they were on in our faces as much as regular customers. And that just shows you, like, food. It's like, yo, we got apples yesterday. How come we don't got apples today? Like, I like the chicken better than the other day. Like, it was the same dialogue. These are now your customers. This is now your everyday. But on the weekends, I went out to Sag Harbor with my family, and I was walking on the beaches there a lot and walking in the woods. I'm like, will hospitality ever come back? And as every month in 21 and going into 22, it felt, okay, maybe. So I was like, if we get a chance to do this again, what is it going to look like? And that's how we built our Chelsea restaurant, Hav Mar. And this piece that we shot was really about how do you build that? And I'm so proud that they got me in a moment where everything wasn't just up, up, up. It was really like, you know, like somebody writing an Unplugged album, or just take it down a notch, because that was the mood that was in the city if you worked in hospitality or most industries at that point.
Yeah, everything. Whatever, everything, you know, down, yeah.
So, yeah, that was fun.
Can I see the Emmy one more time?
Yeah, yes, you can. Yes, you may.
That's crazy.
Hey, now, that's crazy. I want to give you some credit, though. When you talk about during COVID-19, I mean, you served, if I read it correctly, over 280,000 meals to the community, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in Harlem, in Newark, in Miami, you partnered up with the World Central Kitchen, right? And you guys did some amazing things. Why was that?
Yeah, the key word, we did that. Well, yeah. I didn't do it. We did it collectively because it was a couple of things. I think we had restaurants. We knew how to do it. And we had access to, again, community here, but also the community of Chef Jose Andres, right? So when you have something like that, you got to activate it. But I would also say on a pure selfish note, I've done this since I was 17 years old. Got up in the morning and worked, put work in every day. One of the biggest fear for me during COVID was, what's going to happen? Yeah. Like, I've never sat down. Like, I take choices based on my food and how I, you know, use my energy. And like every day since I've been 17, I've been doing this. So if you take that away from me, I don't know myself outside that. So it was also a way to just stay regular when nothing was regular anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And you keep your sanity. And it kept me sane. Yeah. Go in there and serve, you know?
Yeah, and you had the chance to, like you said, to interact with people, yes, which a lot of people didn't do.
Yes.
So that's good. You got to touch, not touch, but you also, you got to be around the community.
Yes. You know? And my cooks, and like, you're a tribe leader. End of the day, when you're a chef, you're driving people forward and they believe in you. And if they showed up, I show up, you know? So, yeah, man.
Yeah.
But we always got to end here. Two things I got to ask you. I mean, is there a brand? Is there a community? Is there an individual that you ultimately want to work with?
I'll answer like this. Opening a restaurant that we just did in Ethiopia and working with the cooking school there.
Wow.
It gave me such a full circle, and it humbled me. And, It was like, whoa, we really did this, you know? And for them, you know, like, for them to see me, to see themselves, it was a big moment, you know?
I bet.
And they're like, whoa, you know? And so that was very special. And it's like opening a rooster. Like, I will never forget that day. I will never forget standing there, being in the school, communicating to these 18, 19 years old. So clearly couldn't connect the pieces at that moment, but like, you know, eventually had something that they can go off for a long, long, long time to be inspired by. I look a lot at sports and music. I think it's amazing that I think what Beyonce is doing on the Carter album, I think it's amazing, inspiring people, bringing people into different spaces that we should take for granted, should be for everybody. But I think it's such an inspiring piece of work that not only the songs, and people can have an opinion on those, but I think the homework that she's done, like mm-hmm. how she's including those Black country singers on Blackbird, or how she's going back and giving honor to people who were in the spaces way before. Like, I think for me, that's inspiring, right? And so people who move you like that, you know, and doing it on such a large global scale, right? Because now there's a Japanese person that wants to be in country and said, oh, I can be it as long as it's good, or whatever it might be, right? So it's not just what's happening in the U.S. We look at it very often, very much as this myopic back and forth between Black and white culture. As a Black person living outside the United States, it's going to have much, much higher, bigger impacts outside the United States, because it's going to allow people to think about themselves, see themselves in spaces that they maybe wouldn't have dared to. And I love that. That's what a mega, now you're mega, now you're a superstar, you know. Look at, that's what Michael Jordan did, right? It wasn't just playing against the Knicks that he did so well, but it was telling like a French guy, you can also be in the NBA, and that's why you got Wemby.
Or a kid in China.
Yeah, a kid in China, exactly.
It's funny, we've went full circle, because you opened up by saying, sometimes it's a little bit about those people that help you, and you being in Ethiopia, you never know who you've touched by being able to open that.
Yeah.
What's the name of the restaurant in Ethiopia? Have you named it yet?
Yeah. It's open. It's in the largest tower in East Africa. It's on the top floor, called Marcus Addis. It's really beautiful. The team did a great job. But it's just, I end up with this little story. So my tribe came in for the opening, right? The guys from the village, not just the guys from the village, right? They never left the village.
Yeah, I just worked with a Senegalese artist, and him and his sister were breaking down some of the tribe things, and we're breaking down why they have arranged marriages. Yeah. And it was very interesting.
Yeah. And they appreciated being able to explain that to you without being like someone telling them they're crazy, like this.
Yeah, no judgment. Beautiful. We're just talking.
Yeah. So, you know, we have to invite the village, and the restaurant's on the 47th floor, and they're coming in their best, right? And everybody come through. And the kids were like, it's the first time for the kids taking the elevator. So they're like crazy going up and down, so much fun. But the elder was like, we're going to walk. We're not going in an elevator. And we're like, you can't walk up 47th floor. You have to actually do the elevator. So for me, moments like that, culture phenomenon.
I mean, you said it was 47 floors?
Yeah. So they're like, okay. You know, and it's this one of these sky elevators. You see the whole city and whatever. But moments like that, that doesn't end up on a poster, but I was there and I saw it. And for them even to see that, they couldn't understand how this thing's going to take you up. It's like, that's when you realize that you come far. You know what I mean? It's so different. It's just so different. Some of the words can't describe it. You know what I mean?
I bet. That's something incredible. Yeah. Actually, that's something incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks once again.
Thank you, Marcus. I'll see you soon.
All right. I'll see you guys.
Thank you very much, Marcus.
All right, brother. Be safe, man.
With this. All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Be safe, man.
Appreciate you guys.
All right, folks. That's our show. Tune in to Unglossy, Decoding Brand and Culture on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. And follow us on Instagram at UnglossyPod to join the conversation. Until next time, I'm Tom Frank.
I'm Jeffrey Sledge.
Smicky!
That was good.